Hi, welcome to Indiana Weekend with John Strauss. This is a kind of radio magazine show about the interesting places and intriguing people in our part of the state. We get out of the studio and onto the road to find the kind of radio you don't hear so much anymore. Stories off the beaten path and usually away from the top headlines. So send us a note if you have an idea or just want to say hi. Our email address is indianaweekend@gmail.com. Can you believe this weather? The good news is the worst may be over. The end of January is the coldest time in Indiana on average. But there's a lot we don't know about why the polar vortex arrived as it did. To find out about that, these terrible ice storms and whiteouts, the blessed approach of spring, the tornado season, chasing tornadoes, we turn to Dr. David Call, a Ball State severe weather expert.
It's been one of the worst winters we've seen in probably a generation. We had a lot of pretty severe winters in the late 70s and early 80s, but since then, most winters have been mild. In the mid-90s, there were a few rough winters. In northern Indiana, 2009 was a particularly rough winter as well, but nothing with this scale of cold and prolonged cold, and to a large extent, snow either. This is going to probably be the snowiest January on record in Indianapolis, and it's going to be one of the snowiest winter seasons, even if it stopped snowing today.
The snow and the cold, you know, they add together to create this misery, but they're not related from a cause standpoint, right?
They are. Sometimes we get a cold and dry pattern. In this case, it's been a cold and stormy pattern. The jet stream, with the storm track that steers a lot of storms, has been consistently bringing moisture from the Pacific Ocean into the Yukon Territory and then down through Alberta and into the central U.S. and giving us a lot of these Alberta Clipper systems, as we call them, the brief few inches of snow followed by wind. In the midst of that, we've also had a few larger East Coast storms that have come up from Texas and across the Ohio Valley, and that gave us the big dumping we saw at the start of the spring semester here at campus.
So is this snap that we had this week, is that this, in terms of severity, is it worse or the same as what we had at the beginning of the semester?
It's akin to what we saw at the beginning of the semester. Temperatures, once again, were more than 10 degrees below zero. That typically only happens once every 5-10 years at the most. We also had days where the temperatures were struggling to get above zero. Most days, the temperatures get above zero, so that's an occurrence that happens once every 10 to 20 years. 1994 was the last time we had days that were completely 24-hour calendar day below zero. We would have had one earlier this month if the times of the hours had lined up correctly, and we were pretty close earlier this week, too.
We always talk about the jet stream as being the cause for bringing this really cold Arctic air down to us. Does anybody know what causes the – okay, so we get the jet stream as the cause, but what causes the jet stream to make these movements?
Well, and to back it up, what the jet stream is itself. I mean, the jet stream, think of it as a giant river of air high up in the atmosphere, and typically it's the dividing line between warm air and cold air. So when the jet stream's to our south, we're cool. When the jet stream's to our north, we're warm. In the summertime, the jet stream's usually up to our north. In the wintertime, it's usually to our south. But this year, it's been unusually far down to the south. It's been down across the Gulf Coast states. They had a major ice storm earlier this week down across the deep south. They've had freezes in northern Florida. So since it's cold down there, it's even colder than normal here because that Arctic air is spilling farther down to the south than normal. So that's the first part of it. The other thing, the jet stream typically moves in waves. And just like when you look at ocean waves or waves on lakes, sometimes those waves are small and sometimes they're big. This year, they've been rather large. The warmth they've had out in California, the dry weather, has been the yin of our yang of cold weather. And because the jet stream's so far north across western Canada, it's taking in a very deep dive to the south across the eastern U.S.
So is there something that's causing the jet stream to dip down so much further south this year?
The weather tends to be variable, and this year it's not so much the dips to the south, it's the fact they've been so persistent. If you look at the jet stream around the globe, you see sort of this necklace that circles the globe with all sorts of waves in it. A lot of times those waves gradually progress through. This year they've been more or less stopped up, so the whole climate system has sort of ground to a halt. If we think of weather patterns as progressing from one place to the next, this year they haven't really progressed. They've just been stagnant. And hence you get massive drought in California, repeated incursions of snow and cold in the east.
part of what we're experiencing this winter is kind of a persistence in the jet stream being so low, right?
Our understanding of why the jet stream's in this pattern is somewhat incomplete. It comes really more in macro meteorology. We're most familiar with that when we hear about things like El Nino. That's probably the most famous oscillation. El Nino refers to occasional warming of waters near the equator in the Pacific Ocean. With satellite meteorology and other remote sensing now, we've started to discover other oscillations or areas around the globe that have disruptive effects on the weather. The North Atlantic Oscillation is a great example of one we've discovered more recently. That relates high and low pressure systems across Greenland and the Azores. We've only been able to monitor that in more recent times with advanced remote sensing technologies. And there are other oscillations, the Arctic Oscillation, the Madden-Julian Oscillation, the Pacific Decadal one. It's becoming a whole alphabet soup of oscillations. So in other words, we look at our individual weather patterns, and now we're starting to be able to fit them into this larger framework that these oscillations set up. So while at this point we're not quite to the point where we can necessarily say this jet stream pattern is caused by oscillation X, Y, and Z working together, I think in the next 20 to 30 years, with advances in computing power, advances in remote sensing technology, and just additional data, we'll start to see some more of those causes and correlations.
From all this, are we able to see what February is going to be like?
The preliminary forecast for February call for a continuation of this pattern, although they do call for some lessening of it. Once we get out a few weeks, climatological forecasting is largely looking at patterns and trends, and especially as you get out more than a month or two, most forecasts trend back toward average. So the trends are suggesting closer to average, but still a little cooler than average. The final result, though, will probably end up being something different than that, either much colder than average or perhaps even typical temperatures for what we see in February.
Ball State's Dr. David Call, a severe weather expert. Coming up, the most deadly winter storm may not be a big storm at all, but a short-lived, sudden blast of snow that causes whiteout conditions and those giant traffic pileups.
Snow.
Indiana Weekend, real radio from just down the road. Look for that name on Facebook and drop us a line to let us know what you think. Email us at indianaweekend@gmail.com. Now here's John Strauss.
It may have happened to you, the short-lived but dangerous whiteout conditions caused by snow and really high winds. It's very scary when it happens. Ball State weather expert David Call remembers when it happened to him, and he thinks about that during the big storms we've had this winter.
Winter weather is your area of specialty. That's what you study. Does that mean that a year like this is time to write some new papers?
Boy, there's been a lot of stuff to study this winter. One thing I've been looking at is the causes of chain reaction accidents, those massive pileups you see on the highways. And sadly, this year I've gotten a lot of new data points because there's been a whole lot of these accidents.
A terrible one on I-94 up near Chicago in Indiana.
Yes, several fatalities with that one, and drivers reported whiteout conditions. And one thing I'm looking into with these, because by this point of the year we should be pretty adept at driving in winter weather, is did something change quickly? So we're doing some radar analysis to try to figure out if it was not necessarily just snow, but a quick change in the amount or intensity of snow. And hopefully that'll help us understand a little more what causes these, and perhaps we can use message boards to warn people more effectively. With severe thunderstorms and tornadoes, we're developing more and more computer algorithms that can take radar images, process them, and alert the meteorologist the potential for a tornado or other sorts of severe weather. And perhaps in the future we could develop an algorithm to do that with winter weather, and they can notice that in some area, for example, precipitation is quickly becoming more intense, or winds are quickly increasing, or some other change. This is why it's research. We're not quite sure what we're going to find yet, but hopefully that could lead to some insights into what causes these, so meteorologists can get the word out effectively and warn people.
Whiteout conditions are terrible. Besides the I-94 accident, there have been several of these in other parts of the country out west, I'm thinking. And can you spot when these things are about to happen, or is there anything
We'll see where this research comes out, but I believe that most of the time people will say these whiteouts came up very abruptly. You're driving along and it's snowy and you may be starting to zone out, and then all of a sudden you realize you can barely see the car in front of you. I lived in Erie, Pennsylvania and Syracuse, New York before I came here and experienced my fair share of whiteouts, and one thing about them is they tend to be rather abrupt. And even if it's already been snowing for a while, after a while you get a comfort level with the snow. We can think of about how much more comfortable we are driving in the snow now compared to what we were a few weeks ago because we've experienced so much this month. So I think sometimes the issue with whiteouts is they catch people off guard. You've sort of settled in for a drive. Anytime you do a long drive, you get into that rhythm. And then all of a sudden the whiteout comes. And I think part of the problem may be people don't necessarily adjust quickly enough to it. I'm not saying that to blame the drivers themselves. It's just you're driving along, encountering one condition, and all of a sudden the condition abruptly changes. Our reaction times aren't instantaneous. I was in one of these accidents myself when I lived in Erie, Pennsylvania, and I got on the highway, and I was driving along, and I looked down at my speedometer, and I was going 50 or 55 miles an hour, and there's traffic everywhere, and I realized that I can barely see anything in front of me. And I said, my gosh, everybody's going way too fast. And all of a sudden, I see cars in front of me just stopping and crashing. And luckily, I steered myself onto the shoulder. There was a pretty wide shoulder and heard more crashes behind me. But it was instantaneous almost. About the point I realized that I was in a bad place, it was already too late for especially the lead cars. And it was just one of these instances. Somebody started spinning. I'm a meteorologist, so I should have known better, I guess, but perhaps there's a piece of the puzzle that we can provide meteorologists and other decision makers that'll help them identify these situations better. Mm-hmm. Because in a winter like this, it's certainly snowing all winter. What causes these accidents versus others? The other thing with the winter weather, we focus on the snow, but if we look at the definition of blizzard, the Weather Service definition of blizzard, it doesn't mention snow to the way we think of it. The Weather Service defines a blizzard as 3 hours or more of visibility of a quarter mile or less and winds frequently gusting 35 miles an hour above. You notice there wasn't anything in there about snow accumulations. To the Weather Service, blizzards are visibility phenomena more than snow falling phenomena. And that makes sense. If we get 6 to 12 inches of snow, most people know it's coming, they'll stock up on provisions, and they'll stay home. Or they'll shelter in place at work. Or they'll very carefully drive home. But in a blizzard condition, you can't see, and especially as you get farther west, where the winds tend to be stronger on average, there were numerous instances, especially in the 1800s and the early 1900s, where people would get lost in blizzards, literally on their own property. A farmer would go to check the mail, or they'd go into town, and they wouldn't be able to get back home because the visibilities and the winds were so bad. So the whiteout conditions are often associated with blizzard-like conditions, which are dangerous because you can't see what's in front of you. You could become disoriented. And then if you get stuck somewhere, the winds will cool you off much more quickly, and hypothermia will set in more quickly.
Dr. David Call, a severe weather expert from Ball State, he leads the storm chasers during tornado season. Coming up, he talks about what that's like.
Riders on the storm. Riders on the storm.
This is Indiana Weekend with John Strauss on Indiana Public Radio.
As bad as January's winter storms were, you can take solace in this. February is usually warmer. Of course, that means that spring is also just around the corner, spring and tornado season. Dr. David Call of Ball State is a severe weather expert who's not content to study storms from a distance.
Well, every year we take out a group of students from Ball State and we go chase storms across the Midwest. It's a great experience for the students, because most of these students are going to be future forecasters and meteorologists warning us about these things. They can see them in front of them, they can see what they look like on radar, and they can get practice forecasting them. Here in Indiana, we may see 2 or 3, maybe 4 days at most in a typical year where there's a potential for tornadoes. On our storm chase trip, almost every day has that potential, so students get a lot of experience with forecasting and observing severe weather. Forecasting is a mixture of education and experience, and of course they get the education in the classroom, but the experience, there's no substitute for it other than experience. So,
what's that like when you're doing it? Because most of us drive the other direction when bad weather comes.
Our chase trips are a lot like acting. Lots and lots of preparation, but the actual time when we're active and doing anything is very small, or even to some extent like pro sports. The amount of time pro athletes spend on games is very small compared to all the time they spend in practices, meetings, conditioning, reviewing video, and all those things. We spend most of our time driving to where we think storms will form and then waiting to see what happens, and the actual chase part of it is often very brief and very rapid. But of course, that's exciting. Just like actors live for that moment when they're up there on the stage or they're shooting that one key scene in a movie, we live for that one moment, those 5 minutes, when we see a mesocyclone or possibly a tornado. Mesocyclone's the precursor to a tornado, rotating wall cloud. Usually when people see those, they get pretty nervous, as they should. So the storm chasing, a lot of it's about driving to places, forecasting, and then just waiting around and being patient. And sometimes the weather pans out and we see things, and other times it just is nothing at all with blue skies. But of course that's true for us here in Indiana. We hear the forecast for storms, and some days it ends up being a parade of storms, and other days backyard barbecues and everything else go on without a hitch.
Can you think of a time when you were out storm chasing and something was coming your way and you thought, oh boy, we're close now?
Maps can have mistakes, and sometimes roads that you think are paved aren't paved. Sometimes storms blow up rather quickly. Most of the time we're in pretty safe locations because storms follow rules. We don't necessarily know all the rules, and there's some chaotic nature to the rules and some fuzziness around them, but we know that if we position ourselves in certain locations relative to storms, we'll usually be safe. The problem is sometimes a new storm will form and upset the apple cart, or we'll think we've got a safe route out and we don't, or things will rapidly change. Most thunderstorms last on the order of minutes to maybe an hour. So with such a short life cycle, they can easily blow up or change dramatically from one radar sweep to the next. We do play more conservatively than a lot of chasers, but as we sadly saw last year when the chasers were killed out in Oklahoma, you can get away with a fair amount of unsafe practices, but some storms are unforgiving and they will catch up with you. I'm not really saying that to blame the victims, because unfortunately the victims in that tragedy were some of the most experienced chasers, but there were a lot of other people that got rolled and did things that they should not have because they had gotten away with it with past storms, and they forgot that storms are dangerous.
It seems like you have some people who are out there for the excitement of it, trying to get video. What are the mistakes that they make?
Well, there are the chasers that are researchers out there collecting data. There are the chasers that are out there that are thrill seekers, the adrenaline junkies. Those ones are menaces on the roads. There are also those that are trying to get the perfect shot. And as we've seen over the last decade or two, reality TV has really rolled onto the scene. YouTube has rolled onto the scene. In the past, it was sufficient to station a news reporter somewhere near a weather event and say there's a hurricane coming or there's a thunderstorm outbreak, where now people tune in and they expect to see people getting thrown around. Used to be cool to have a video of a tornado because those were so unusual. Now, if you don't see debris or the person filming the video is not in danger, it's not going to get picked up. And so the audience for these videos craves those things. And if you're a thrill seeker, an adrenaline junkie, or even if you're not, you sort of expect now to get those things.
Are people taking chances to get that stuff that they shouldn't be?
Sure, there are people taking chances to get that stuff. There are also times where sometimes your experience works against you because maybe you took a chance in the past and got away with it. Most of the time, storms aren't severe. Most of the time, they don't produce tornadoes. So there are lots of times you can go out storm chasing and do whatever you want, and it's not going to matter because the storm's not going to be severe. Or even if it's severe, it's not going to be a strong enough wind to roll your car over or to bash out your windshield. The problem is, when you're out in the field or whether you're in the forecast office, you generally can't tell until after the storm if it's going to be one that's going to drop a EF3 tornado or if it's just going to pelt some hail and break a few windshields. And that's why when we're out there, we're pretty careful to follow a fair amount of chasing rules, because we have to assume that all storms are going to be those killer storms.
So we have these big cold snaps, and inevitably somebody's going to say, well, so much for global warming. You must get tired of hearing that.
I do. And it's because it's such a basic error. People disagree about global warming. It's a policy debate. The scientists mostly agree, but scientists don't make policy with good reason. We elect politicians to make decisions about policy because anytime a politician makes a policy change, there will be winners and losers, and their job, at least if we view the system in an ideal sense, is to weigh those winners and losers and try to figure out the best thing for society moving forward. In any case, weather and climate are two distinct things. Global warming deals with climate, which is a long-term average of weather. Weather is what we have right now, and it can vary a lot from day to day, week to week, month to month, and year to year. Not only that, we personally experience weather. We think of it, wow, it's very cold here. We don't just see it, but we experience all with all of our senses. But it's easy to forget that in other places that we're not directly sensing, the weather can be quite different. This year, while it's been very cold here, it's been unusually hot in California, and Australia is having one of their worst summers on record. Likewise, Alaska has been warmer than here. So just because it's cold in our part of the globe doesn't mean it's cold elsewhere. And just because it's cold this year doesn't necessarily mean that it hasn't been warm for the last 20 years. One reason this winter has seemed so brutal is because we haven't had many winters like this in the past few decades, because generally our winters have been getting warmer. So the two important distinctions there are between weather and climate, and also between the fact that what's going on right now is not necessarily representative of what's going on across the entire globe. Global warming could cause some places to cool, and there are hints that it will, but when we talk about global warming, we're looking at the whole planet and the average for the entire planet. So some places are going to warm more than others, and some places, say, may even cool. In fact, if we look at global warming over the last 100 years, almost all of the warming has been concentrated up in polar regions. Temperatures near the equator and really anywhere in the tropics have barely changed at all, and temperatures in a lot of mid-latitude places like the continental United States have changed a little, but not enough that people would notice it. Where they notice it, though, is up in the poles. In fact, that brings me to one other mistake we sometimes assume with global warming. We think it'll always be warm, and the magnitude of change of global warming is, for most places, very small, just a few degrees. So what that means for us here in Muncie is, instead of having temperatures of -5 in the winter, they might get down to -2 or -3. That's not enough that most people are going to notice it. And likewise, in the summer, instead of having temperatures up around 88, for summertime highs, they'd be in the low 90s. So for the most part, global warming changes are difficult for us to perceive.
Ball State's Dr. David Call on the frigid weather we've just endured, a little bit about how global warming works, and the adventures of a storm chaser. That's our show for today. I'm John Strauss. Big thanks to our producer, Marcus Jackman. Glad you could join us this time and hope you'll stay in touch. Throw another log on the fire and drop us a note about your own winter travails. In the meantime, think spring. Thanks and have a great week. Until we meet again on the next Indiana Weekend on Indiana Public Radio, I'm John Strauss.
Indiana Weekend with host John Strauss of the Ball State Journalism Department. Our show is engineered at Indiana Public Radio, produced by Marcus Jackman. Major support for Indiana Weekend comes from Dillman's Furniture, Muncie, serving East Central Indiana with home furnishings from Flex Steel, Bassett, and Simmons Beautyrest. Join us again next week for Indiana Weekend with John Strauss here on Indiana Public Radio.